State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy is joining us for our weekly Tacky Talk chat. Hey, Tacky, what's going on?
Hey Joe, it's good to see you on a actually it's thir as a tacky Thursday, huh?
Yeah, we're back to our old time slot here for a little bit anyway.
Yeah, things aren't bad. For the purposes of formal sessions, we finished those up last night in the legislature. We are still going to do informal sessions every 72 hours where one person can object to a bill and a voice vote and stop the session. But at this stage of the game, committees are making reports out heavily as we get into the winter months. Actually, I have a poll out from my committee that's actually due Thanksgiving week, actually next Tuesday. It's a small poll, so it's not like there's a lot of votes required on it, but we still have to get the process moving. And of course, December 3rd is when the Senate side reports all the bills out, or I expect the supermajority bills out of committee. So the House is now watching the Senate see what they do, because the House reporting system is much more truncated on 60 days and 90 days, or 90 days after the hearing itself, where the Senate actually has it December 3rd. So, even though that formal sessions have closed, there's a lot of monitoring going back and forth on those House and Senate committees. In addition, I got to start setting up the January, February, March schedule for the committee in December and get through the next set of bills we should be pulling out early January. And this committee does get late filed bills. Late filed bills are bills filed after the deadline. It requires the House and Senate Rules Committee to approve. And we should be getting the next set of those during the holiday period. And then, working with the co-chair, we'll try to figure out the early part of the hearing schedule, probably January, most likely sometime in January.
Okay. So can we talk about three that we chatted about before we started recording? There's the workplace violence prevention, higher education, and then protecting the Constitution.
Yeah, we'll go. The workplace issue is particularly in the healthcare setting. So we're setting up standards guidelines regarding workplace prevention and healthcare in particular. Attacks in a healthcare setting, sadly, is becoming more commonplace. Violent patients, violent visitors will assault healthcare workers. So we're going to provide some in. I want to say, well, I think we could provide, basically provide penalties for assault, and specifically for assault of healthcare workers, targeting that victim, but also requiring healthcare settings to have a uniform prevention on healthcare workers, and also what to do in the case it happens, because it's a very non-uniform method right now. So people don't realize that people can become violent, and in this day and age, for some reason, people feel the need to be more belligerent than ever, particularly in a hospital, community hospital, urgent care, home health care type settings.
Yeah,
I
it's
can't.
unfortunate. And I know this is not a new issue. Years ago, I know that some members of the state nursing union came here to QATV hoping to put a program together just to inform people about this issue. And that at that time, it astounded me. I'm thinking, why are people assaulting these healthcare workers that are trying to help them? It just didn't make sense to me.
And that question is still an outstanding question. Everyone's an individual, so we can't kind of bl blanket it all as one reason. But yeah, it is astounding that you would assault people that are your caretakers, particularly in time of vulnerable. Obviously, we do know people get under stress, and perhaps they have some mental challenges, and sometimes they may have emotional issues associated with being in a healthcare setting. Other times, it's not actually the patients, it's actually friends or visitors that come in
Yeah.
and they get belligerent. And you're right, it's actually astounding. And the place that needs to be a safe place so all patients and workers feel they're able to give the best care they can, but also for patients to be able to be safe and not feel like you're threatened, which will impede their healing process.
Right. Yeah. I couldn't help but wonder if, because of the shortage in healthcare workers, there's obviously more longer wait times, and that maybe compounds the anxious feelings.
I can't explain it, to be honest. I mean, it just boggles my mind that it's over. I think the stat was 4%.
Yeah, that's what they quoted. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah.
One is too many, but 4% is astonishing. And because in a place that we, we make a safe space. Healthcare settings are a safe space. You don't bring a firearm into a hospital. You're expected to check in registration, especially after hours. The healthcare workers, depending on which unit you're in, will let you or not allow you bring certain items in, depending on the unit you're visiting someone. So, unfortunately, I've done my share of hospital visits. And I think a lot of people listening have obviously, I think somebody's been in a hospital once, and every unit's different. And
Right.
those healthcare workers, the people you trust to care for your loved one and yourself.
Yeah, I mean, most emergency departments now have an armed guard on duty 24 hours a day. It's that's just a sad fact.
I never remember that as a younger person.
Likewise, yeah.
Yeah, this is the changing times we live in. It's unfortunate we actually have to pass a bill of this type. So you're right, the Massachusetts Nurse Association, SEIU Local 1199, SEIU Local 509, and other healthcare organizations, have been supporting and is supporting this bill that the House passed. And the bill is on its way to the Senate now. So,
Okay.
we'll hope the Senate will take it up sometime early next year.
Okay. Very good. All right. We'll follow that certainly.
Yeah, the higher education bond bill is like 3.6, I think, $1 billion or $8 billion. It's basically literally what it sounds like. It's a higher education bond bill. It provides capital bonding money available for the governors, which is in DCAM, the Department of Capital Asset Management, to provide to the state colleges, universities, and the community colleges for what it sounds like building and equipment, facility upgrades.
Okay.
At UMass Amherst is the flagship. I was at UMass a couple of weeks back for a tour of an Asian community business. I went on campus, and it's basically a giant town, right? UMass Amherst. But we're also aware that a lot of other smaller community colleges and universities don't have the revenue stream as UMass Amherst. And while the UMass system is allowed to bond on its own, providing some assistance from our bonding, using our bonding rating and our bonding capacity, will provide a bit of relief for the state colleges and schools that aren't as big as
Right.
UMass Amherst.
Yeah. Salem State, Bridgewater State, places like that.
Precisely to
Yeah.
allow them to do building renovations, build new buildings, bring the facilities to the 21st century. And
Sure.
that's good for students, that's good for staff, that's good for everyone. And obviously, you guys know capital stuff isn't like overnight. You got to design it, you got to plan it, then you can put it together. So obviously, some priority is going to go that universities and colleges that are a little further along in the state system are going to get prioritized. But
Yeah.
we'll leave that to DCAM to figure out.
Okay. Yeah, it could help. I know there's a lot of kids from Quincy go to Fitchburg State, actually, so that could help Quincy kids too.
Absolutely, particularly the smaller schools,
Yeah.
because they don't have the ability to bond like the bigger schools can on their own. And this will give them a little bit of relief. And that like I said, it's a multi-year process that people will see over time.
Okay. And that passed the House, you said?
Pass the House on the way to the Senate. We'll see how it plays out again next year when the Senate takes up the bill.
Okay.
The last issue is this Article 5 issue, which some people listening maybe or may not be aware of. So this Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution creates a mechanism for the Constitution to be amended by I'm trying to remember the number now. This is, oh God, I'm trying to remember now. I think it's fourth-fifths of the states.
Oh, in total of the 50?
Yeah, that
Oh.
vote by some resolution or affirmative agreement by the state legislature that they will form a constitutional convention that now I gotta look this thing up. Two-thirds. Okay. Two-thirds of all states agreed to call a constitutional convention under Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution. Can call a convention propose amendments to the Constitution and then continue on in the amendment approval process. There's a little bit that sounds like amending the Constitution using state legislatures.
Okay.
These provisions never been done before. All constitutional amendments have been done through acts of Congress and then
Right.
approved by the states after the approval of Congress. There is no instruction manual for this. There is nothing in the Constitution dictating how it works. This is kind of all guesswork. So the Massachusetts is a participant by resolution many years ago to be part of Article 5. Well, back then, when people ask why, it's because of Citizens United case that the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that under the First Amendment, corporate entities are considered people for the purposes of campaign donations. Entities can donate, which changed campaign finance law forever. That ruling, I believe, was back in 2006, eight, something like that. So it's been many years, and about 17 states, far from two-thirds, but 17 states around the country had agreed to move forward on a constitutional convention, including Massachusetts. Well, we are now no longer in that time period, and states have started rescinding these provisions because a lot of states that leaned a Republican had resisted joining a constitutional convention because they didn't want to repeal Citizens United because it would impact their races on campaign donations. Massachusetts, for example, prohibits corporations from donating. So you have any kind of business entity, you can't donate to me or county or city official. And Office of Campaign Political Finance do really hard work trying to keep track of the donations and try to weed out things that are fraudulent and shady and try to bait and switch that kind of stuff. OCPF, which is what we call it, Office of Political Campaign Finance, we give them a lot of credit because it's not an easy job because they do a lot of municipalities, not all, but the bigger municipalities, but also the state county races. And of course, we have PACs, right? Political Action Committees. They have to monitor that stuff as well. So, give them a lot of kudos. It's not an easy job. So that's a real impetus for that. People always ask, is the state in compliance with Citizens United? And we rely on the Office of Political Campaign Finance to make sure that we are in compliance with federal regulations on campaign donations, well, for court cases. So, while we're not a federal entity, we are still subject to the First Amendment of the Constitution regarding political speech, and political speech is campaign donations also. So that was a lot of impetus early on. And given the change in political environment, trying to change the Constitution by convention of states, many states feel that, including us, that given the current political environment, and especially watching the redistricting changes in some states, including California and Texas, midstream in non-census years, there could be all kinds of new mischief that could occur if we get to the two-thirds threshold. And who knows what will happen in that scenario? Because again, I repeat, there are no instruction manuals on how to do this. The expectation, I think, was that some way that something will figure out on its own. But given the fact that it's been many years and only 17 states has decided to participate in this exercise, it also seems kind of pointless after so long and no one else wants to join.
I was just going to say the same thing. Like, if it hasn't been used after almost 20 years, why now?
That's correct. So I was like, oh, well, nice idea when people first proposed it. And clearly, a lack of participation by all states, then why are we even bothering continuing to be a signatory to this idea? So, the House and Senate decide to just withdraw ourselves. And all it is a resolution. We actually do not have to file a bill. There's no law that says
Oh, I
that.
get you. Okay.
Yeah. Surprisingly, it is the legislatures that decide to call it a convention, it is not a gubernatorial act.
I see. Okay, interesting. And is that the same to change the state constitution also?
No, state constitution can be done by two methods. One method is by a legislator filing a constitutional amendment, which is not uncommon, but it requires 50% of both bodies in a joint session. So all 200 of us have to get together and you have to get 101 votes. You have to do it in two consecutive different sessions, meaning that has to be two different election cycles of legislators before you can put it on the ballot to the voters. If it's a voter initiative, oh no, I'm sorry, I got it backwards. If it's a voter initiative, it needs 101 votes. If it's a legislative initiative, it only needs 25%.
Oh, okay. All
I'm
right.
sorry,
That's
I got
better.
that backwards.
Okay.
So if I filed a constitutional amendment, I have to convince 50% of the votes, 50 votes, sorry, 50 votes out of 200, that's one quarter, right? to go with it and have to do it again in two consecutive legislative sessions.
Gotcha.
And then you put it before the voters then. And now you're really making me rethink my percentages because this is
You
what
didn't know this was
happened.
going to be a class in constitutional law, did
Yeah, I mean,
you? See, this is how we all learn together, Jackie.
yeah, this is how we're along together. You're killing me right now. It's the whole percentages that messes me up. Is it half for a one foul by a legislator, or is it 25%? And then, or is it the other way around? That's the part that I keep getting confused by, because it's not the same process in terms of total votes of the Constitutional Convention.
Oh, all right, all
That
right.
part keeps throwing me off
Okay.
because I believed it was a lower threshold to have a legislator to get past the Constitutional Convention.
You
I'm gonna
see,
have to.
these are just natural questions that arise out of my inquisitive nature.
Yeah, and it's making me
You know you'll have to find the answer, otherwise you'll lose sleep over it.
yeah. So to advance a proposed amendment approved by at least 25% of legislators in a joint session of the General Court needs to be done for a constitutional amendment that is provided by the public through signature gathering.
Okay.
That means it's the opposite. If it's a legislative proposal, it has to be 50% plus one,
Okay, so 101.
101. So yeah, it's 25% if it's a citizen initiative of the Constitutional Convention. If it's a legislative proposal, it has to be a majority. The case on this is back on when we did debate of gay marriage in 2003, because the initial a change request, I believe, was citizen petition regarding repealing gay marriage,
Oh,
and
okay.
then it was further amended to floor, which became a legislative issue, which shifted vote number up to 101.
Gotcha.
Because while you can file a citizen initiative, it is still essentially a piece of legislation,
Right.
and then chaos ensued regarding the processes. And as you all know from history books, we did not change the Constitution in the matter. Well, I wasn't there yet. I was a staffer, but I wasn't a legislator. But that's how I got to try to recall how this works, because that was the last time I remember a real contentious constitutional change, because we had also done this to initiate the millionaire's tax.
Oh, yeah.
That so-called millionaire's tax, actual 4% after first $101 million of income. Because now you're making me think through the archives of my brain, because that I did vote for in two legislative sessions in the Constitutional Convention.
Okay.
Yeah, it was 101. It had to be more than 101 votes in both instances.
Okay. All right. All right. See, wait, I knew I'd get to the answer. Just it took a roundabout way to get there.
You're making me think on the fly, and this you and I think the audience has discovered there's a lot rolling around in my brain. It just takes time to like get it out.
That's okay. The great thing about these podcasts is we have the
Yeah, well, I could try to burn the clock by sitting here just rolling through memory lane, trying to remember real examples of implementation of constitutional provisions.
No, let's not do that. We don't want to put people to sleep. But
So,
it's I find it interesting at least.
well, I hope everyone else as well does and do realize that you can know you're not prepared when you literally have to like remember off the top of your head, then look up on your computer to. It's the constitutional amendment process for petitioners on the Secretary of State website while actually talking to you at the same time.
Oh, you get an A plus for multitasking,
Because
Tacky.
I
You did
won't go to sleep if I don't give you the right answer.
great. See, I told you. And it was I didn't, pre-plan that. It's just these questions come up as we talk about these things.
We've actually talked about this for doing the millionaire's tax like many years ago now,
Yes.
but again, this is another refresher because you may not remember that conversation of the
I'm sure I
millionaire's
don't.
tax. I don't expect the audience to remember that specific episode either.
I'm sure they don't. Each one of these episodes is its own individual entity. This is not a continuing thread of conversation.
It's a different type of saga.
That's right, exactly. Speaking of sagas, I think as did we talk last week when the government had finally reopened, or was
We
it?
did a little. We did a little bit talk about
Yeah.
this and the amount of time it's going to take to actually reopen. You can't.
Yes.
People are back to work, but now behind on work, well to a month. And the Secretary of Transportation has lifted the reduction of flights with the
Right.
airlines. But again, the airlines has to get back on the rebooking process and rescheduling process for their flights. So the disruptions that were created does not snap your fingers and magically reverse course overnight.
Right. Yeah,
So,
it's like turning an ocean liner.
yeah, and like I said before, we're still waiting out on our level a lot of that one big beautiful bill, because the federal government has to issue regulations and guidelines of how to do a lot of implementation. It's not just about taxes; it's all the social programs that the federal government pays for. And we talked a little bit about SNAP and others that did come up before the shutdown, but we're still waiting on things like Medicaid and so many other programs that may not affect you, but does affect somebody.
Right. And heating assistance, I understand too, is still a question.
That's 100% right. And we don't know the answer because the government shutdown slowed down the entire process of implementation. And the implementation dates vary. A lot of them are going to come in on January 1st, but also a lot's going to come in October 1st of next year.
Right.
So it's putting us in kind of an anxious position in state government and most likely also local government, because of a lack of assurity or guidelines or guidance on what we're supposed to do and what they're doing and what our reaction and response should be. But also it's data problems, right? We talk about the CPI a lot here. We talk about the unemployment rate a lot. That stuff is all delayed. They're not going to do an October jobs report because they couldn't do the survey in October.
Right.
They provide a September report, which is irrelevant now. So we're going to be waiting for the November report. Hopefully we'll have a November report. Cross your fingers. Maybe we have a November report. Otherwise, we may not see like an unemployment report until January regarding December. It's going to
Yeah.
be very data lagging on this
Yeah,
stuff.
that's dangerous because you can lose control of the economy before you even know it's happening.
And it also gives you an idea, a reflection of what the economy looks like. But it's also hard to make decisions and forecast out. For example, unemployment rate's important to us, including the state unemployment rate, obviously, because it gives a forecast on needs of human services. And given the changes in the federal government on human services, dramatic changes in human services, it's hard for us and other agencies to start projecting out what the potential need may look like.
Right. No. Yeah. For instance, I was speaking to Beth Ann Strollo from QCAP not too long ago, and they're having trouble getting data on the heating assistance because the federal workers that administer that program have all been fired.
The EPA has had terminations, and the Secretary of Education is basically shutting down her own department. The Secretary will basically eliminate the Department of Education, and many of those department responsibilities will likely be reallocated to other ones. For example, a good piece did end up going to places like Small Business Administration, which I don't understand why, but it isn't like they shifted the workforce over.
Right, exactly. They're just not there. Yeah.
They're not there. And then you might have some other secretariats assuming greater responsibilities, but no additional help.
Yeah, and I just read this morning the attempt to dissolve FEMA.
Yeah, we talked to some of our friends about FEMA. It's actually an interesting conversation because one of the proposals the administration has is just give the states money to run their own FEMAs. Well, the problem with that is that not every state has a functional FEMA.
Right.
We have
Massachusetts does. It has MEMA. Yeah.
MEMA. Massachusetts has its own FEMA. And the funny thing is, it actually works pretty well. I mean, anytime there's a snowstorm to activate the bunker, although the news doesn't always report anymore about the governor making way to the bunker, right? I mean, Blizzard 78, the governor was trapped in a bunker. The
That's
caucus
right.
never left the bunker for like a month.
Yes, we saw that same sweater that he wore for weeks
Yeah.
on end.
Yeah. I don't think he shaved either. I mean, everyone's a mess, right? So, reporters used to report, the governor heading to the bunker during major storm events or in situations like the Boston bombing, 9/11, the bunker's activated. ready for any kind of response. And we last saw that during COVID, in response particularly to the healthcare crisis on, sadly, including things like dealing with cadavers.
Yes.
MIMO was in actually charge of the unsure regarding the danger level regarding people who passed away
Yeah.
on an infectious disease. So that's one of the things that MIMO was in charge of during COVID. Not exactly a story that the media put a lot out on,
It's
but
true.
they do a lot of things like that. That's their job. So some states have no emergency management capacity whatsoever and very dependent on federal government for them to assume that role. So even if you give a state government money, it doesn't matter if the entity doesn't exist.
That's true. What is that? What does where does that money go? It just kind of sits, right?
And your insurance rates, if you're living in a flood zone because you paid a higher mortgage,
Yeah.
helps pays for FEMA.
Yes.
So a lot of FEMA funds is not exactly state type dollars. There's actually a lot of home insurance dollars that's surcharged on you because you live in a high hazard area, not just in Massachusetts, but around the country. And what a complaint we got in 2017 and 18, after those winter storms that really negatively impacted Howell's Neck, Marymount, Adams Shore, and Germantown in particular, is the equity of distribution of those funds. So one of the challenges, of course, is that not all states are made equal regarding capacity to pay for things because some states don't have any taxes. And your money, and actually federal tax dollars too, actually subsidize those other states that have no income taxes. And they become, I like to say, welfare states of the federal government because they have really no capacity to operate independently without them on a dollar basis. And that's what's going to happen here is that we're going to again try they want to redistribution funds if they go forward with it, redistribution funds, FEMA funds, which is your surcharges on your mortgage and also your tax dollars to these other states that are not equipped to do any of this work.
Yeah. So it may, at least here in Massachusetts, be beneficial. And this Quincy has its own city emergency management agency as well.
Yeah, bigger communities have their own agencies. The smaller communities are dependent on the state to provide them support. And that is a broad range of support. A lot of places do have regional school districts, right? We don't know what that's like in a big city. We do not have state troopers as our primary law enforcement. Little tiny towns, 1,000-person towns don't have their own law enforcement agency. They rely on state police. Right. We actually have a fire chief. We have investigatory units regarding fire situations. Of course, the fire marshal still has to come here. Other smaller communities only have a fire marshal people. They don't have anybody else to rely on. So,
We do forget that sometimes. It's true. Yeah.
yeah, and some small communities are 100% part-time employees. So your town hall is not opened, half the time. And you work, they're working part-time at town hall and part-time doing something else. And I'm going to tell you, this is not uncommon around the country. I promise you, smaller communities, are like the ones in Massachusetts where they do not have full-time government employees. You're going to have to wait longer to get your stuff done. And it's going to be hours that may not be convenient for anyone. That's just how it is when you have a small community with basically no tax base.
Yeah, there are still some volunteer fire departments around the country where, if there's a fire, they respond from their homes and they're volunteering,
No, we still have the Massachusetts too. We do have volunteer firefighters. So again, one of the benefits of living in a city in Massachusetts, Quincy is not the biggest Massachusetts city, but there is some advantages to doing that. And that's kind of part of one of the benefits of living here. Yeah, I understand taxes are a little bit high and understand that the property taxes is regressive and a burden. But it's really about services that you may need, God forbid, that are available in case of emergencies, as in addition to your, as they say, pothole and tree trimming, right? In addition to your life needs. And it's like an insurance, like your tax dollars being as insurance against potential disasters, because the last thing you want is that something bad happens, nobody shows up because we decide not to spend money on it. So you save some money, but down the road, God forbid something happens, well, you're out of luck.
Yeah, when the water main breaks at 3 in the morning, you don't want to wait till, 10 o'clock the next day to get it fixed.
Or if you're a smart enough community, maybe a lot longer than that, they just shut the water off.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So,
Things we take for
like,
granted, right? Yeah.
well, it's that's why we talk about this stuff here, because while it's great, you have a lot of local officials talk about this stuff. You know, guys like myself and John Keenan and Ron Mariano and Bruce Ayers, you know, can talk about other communities and so forth. So obviously, they represent towns. I've never represented a town as a rep. But obviously, when I worked for Michael Morrissey as a senator, we represented five towns with, you know, I had to learn about town government. And the nature of being the legislature involves us actually have to learn about other communities every so often and take trips to those communities to find out what's going on,
Yeah, particularly
especially.
the Senate district, it's pretty diverse. There's Holbrook, Abington, Rockland, small towns.
Small towns. And, you know, as a chair, you know, sometimes we get requests from reps to come to visit the communities, talk about important issues for them, which means I actually have to leave my house in Quincy, which I don't know, I don't like doing. As well as in the case of being part of the Asian Caucus, there's a lot of Asian Americans that live all over the state, and they want someone to hear their concerns and also discuss their issues. For example, right, I was in Amherst a few weeks back on a business tour to visit, you know, how Asian businesses develop in Western Massachusetts.
Interesting. Yeah, not a place you would think of, right? Off the top of your head, right? You'd think Boston, North Shore.
Yeah, and also different attitudes. People in Central Western and way West have a very different attitude of folks on the east side of
Sure.
the
Yeah.
state. And I'm sure some people listening may have relatives or come from regions outside of Quincy who may have had certain views about people who live in the, on the waterfront. And then we talk to people that live here. It's a very different attitude about people that live outside this region. So one of the benefits of being the legislature, so you get a kind of an expansive view of the state. And you know, I do some foreign affairs, so I have an expansive view regarding other countries that come to my doorstep to discuss, you know, business in Massachusetts, and gives a kind of more comparative view that you may not get from a municipal official when you interview them.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's how you learn, right? You have to experience it, boots on the ground.
Experience does matter. And like you say, you know, it's good to see it, touch it, you know, actually have a feel for it. You know, if you're in a restaurant, it's good to smell and taste, right? You know, doing music, it's good to hear. But even in the business setting, I mean, observing, listening, watching, you know, is a big part of it. And observing other governments and how they do things and asking questions is how we all learn to make better public policy.
Yeah,
It's
yeah.
not just my idea is the only idea. Most of my ideas is a compilation of a whole bunch of other people's ideas through an education process for me to reach certain conclusions or certain possible outcomes, you know, on different policy decisions. It's too often perceived that you only hear from one person and the last person you hear from is the decision you make. That is not how I do things. It never has. You may not like my decisions, but the decisions aren't made in a vacuum with just one thought. It's a compilation of experiences and spending time with the folks. And even my own staff is a aristocratic method of the discussion and encourage agreement and disagreement among ourselves, trying to decide, you know, when is the best thing to do as a committee chair. So,
Well,
you know, that's just how I operate.
that's really the core of your job, right? You're representing these people.
Yeah, representing my constituency, but there's a large responsibility also representing the state itself
Right.
because we are your how do I put this? Your not intermediary. I'm trying to find the right word, but you know, we're the face
Yeah.
sometimes of other states and other countries regarding Massachusetts. Even though I don't represent the whole state like a governor or another constitutional officer, you know, when they meet need, the expectation is that you should behave as a dignitary and respond in the same level of courtesy and graciousness and professionalism, you know, as a legislator.
Sure.
And this extends not just, you know, in formal settings, but also, you know, how you conduct yourself in public, and in the media. And I've been interviewed by foreign media well, before COVID, I got to visit other countries,
Right, yeah.
as a guest. And, you know, I got interviewed by local media, and you should behave as if you're representing, not your just your constituency, but, you know, the Commonwealth. And sometimes that's lost on people. There is an elevated responsibility as an elected official to be a good example to the public. And I do understand that all people are different. I understand that we are imperfect. I like to say that all the time. But some people deliberately go out there just to stir the pot.
Can we change topics a little bit because it's in the news now? Rent control. Looks like there might be a ballot question next year regarding rent control.
Yeah, I saw that. It looks like they got through the first step threshold on rent control. And if they have the certified signatures, the essentially becomes a bill at the State House next year. And it has to, I believe, sometime in early May for the legislature to report it out. If legislature does not pass it into law, then it goes straight to the ballot after another a series of signature collections, which is actually a lower threshold, I believe, at that point than the original threshold. And they're relying on a marketing of creating or forcing the creation of affordable housing. It's going to be very interesting how this comes up because there's no, believe it or not, there's no proof in advertising requirement for ballot questions, believe it or not.
Yeah, now we talked about this before. Yeah.
And the full disclosure and the complexity of public policy and the ballot question on a 15-second ad is troubling to deal with.
Right.
And we've seen this before more than once, and we got the right catchphrase. People remember the catchphrase, and that's how they're going to vote despite what happens.
Yeah, it's true.
So, some voters may not be aware of it. I mean, for example, when we did clean elections, many voters did not realize back in, I think clean election was like 1994 or six, something like that. People didn't realize that that's all funded by your tax dollars to give to an elected official, a candidate, not elected by a candidate. That has no accountability on returning funds if they misuse said funds.
Right.
So there's a lot of
It was very confusing. I remember it, yeah.
it was very confusing on implementation because
People thought they were voting to not give money to elected officials. That's how it was sold.
yeah, and the reality is that it was implemented to do a cost shift because there'd be a much more higher number of candidates. And of course, back then the dollar amount's much lower because
Right.
different from today's cost of doing business. But still, I mean, it would result in the legislature making hard decisions and shifting money around on an unpredictable number of potential candidates that would run. And, it was well intentioned, but
Right.
the voters didn't understand some of the differences on what happens. I mean, it's like Prop 2.5. I mean, former Congressman Capiano worked in taxation committee in the House, I believe, and had to work on Prop 2.5. Fixing the bill, right, to actually implement what you have today for Prop 2.5, trying to get back to the intention because the language didn't work. I talked to us about marijuana legalization. They created no liability regarding people to sell to underage. It didn't actually, it set an age restriction based on the belief of the seller, not actually stating a requirement to demonstrate identification.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, we actually talked about this.
Did we?
Yeah. That was one of the big things that I was really kind of not happy about because other substances and require age and we and
Yeah, like cigarettes and alcohol, right?
yeah, and it's not based on a judgment call by the person selling product.
Oh, that's not right.
No, and that was actually in the ballot question, which of course we took that out
Right.
when you write that whole law in 3 months. I was on that marijuana committee for 3 months, and it was that was just a mad rush to get there. So all I'm saying is buyer beware regarding ballot questions. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, you really have to read through those red booklets the Secretary of State puts out with the full language, and it's cumbersome to read.
Know that's my job.
Right.
That's
Yeah.
why you elect us, is try to understand what these are, proposals by people, and then we think it's a good idea based on a series of input by a lot of folks. We have to redraft and rewrite those laws, or we propose new ones on our own.
Right. Yeah, I do like the summaries that are put together, and also the predicted outcomes of passage or non-passage of that question. That's very helpful.
It is. And given that you have more groups like BU, for example, has a resource center regarding ballot questions. And there are more entities out there looking at it than have been in the past. But as you can see from the initial filing, there's like 45 ballot question proposals. because you only need 10 people to do the initial filing, but you still have to
Right.
get the signatures. And there's no law that prohibits you hiring professional signature gatherers versus a volunteer signature gatherers. So, sometimes it leans in favor of a person with the deeper pockets to be able to get a ballot initiative on.
So what do you think about rent control?
The voters repealed it in the early 90s.
Yes.
And there was only really two communities, Cambridge and Boston.
Right.
And it's how you also created two interesting scenarios. One, you had people with means living in rent control because they got the apartment when it was rent control, when they had lower incomes. And as they made more money, the rent didn't really move that much. So they saved a lot compared to everybody else, which in the intention is to allow people with lesser means to get rent control units. Why would a landlord not keep a good tenant who has higher, even though has higher means over the course of decades, or they sign like a 10-year lease? Suddenly they go from, regarding their business or career, go from a relatively low salary to a extremely high salary, but they're basically saving a lot of money versus someone else on a low salary next door, is going to be paying higher rent because the rent control is the rent that you pay at the time you're at, that as opposed to the time you begin. So the longer you're in
Right.
rent control unit, you actually beat everyone else around you who leave their units, and then they start again in new rent. So it's got that one issue. And the second one, of course, is the so-called slumlord issue, right? Slumlords, is a derogative term against landlords who do not make any investments nor are responsive to tenants, and basically, turns into a slum. That happened in places like Cambridge, where they had rent control. I'm not saying they will always happen, but it also limits revenue, which then, can impact capital improvements to the property. That can become a public safety issue, which could result in a shutdown of the building if the health department, building department, review it and there's not enough capital improvements. If you're not making enough money, then you're just gonna just call it a day.
It's and also there, I mean, there's no cost control for the owners of these properties. Their costs, continue to rise, or real estate taxes, insurance, maintenance. So you can see where there'd be a disparity there.
Well, we've all been very, very acutely aware for the last 5 years, cost fluctuations of just maintaining our lifestyles at the level that we enjoy, right? Remember, lumber costs were out of control during COVID,
Oh yeah,
right?
it was like $100 for a sheet of plywood, I think.
Yeah, and if you're a situation where let's say you're a smaller landlord, let's say you only have three units and the roof goes out, and wood is a very high price, shingles become a very high price during the time period. You can make that decision, we'll just patch it, won't take any more tenants, and then, we'll figure what to do later on. There's also, we keep forgetting the Airbnb issue, right? People who do short-term rentals as a business takes more housing off the market. I think too many of us believe that this is actually somebody's home, or that they bought and they live there full time, but they just happen to go on vacation for a month and decide to make some extra money. Now, I know people that have vacation homes where they're really only there 2 out of 12 months, and they basically rent it out, for the other 10.
Oh yeah, it's very common in especially, the Cape, Berkshires, vacation destinations.
Yeah, and that's one more unit of housing that isn't available for someone who needs it today, rent or buy. That's what, when we did short-term housing law, we made a differential, different amount of units. You have X number of units, you shift up and down on what we need to do as compliance as a business. So we recognize that some folks may be, yeah, you can be gone away for a month of European vacation. You figure, hey, I'll make a little extra money. Other folks, you're right, use a vacation home. Other folks just basically buy the property and make it into short-term rentals. New York is actually very bad right now on that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, New York in particular, people buy whole buildings and basically do short-term rentals, and they're not technically hotels.
Ah, yes. Okay. Yep. Interesting.
So they don't really have to like do all the same amenities as a hotel does.
Right. Or pay the same hotel taxes, right?
Yep. Yeah, we do. I mean, I don't know what it is in New York, but I mean, Massachusetts, there is a tax type structure, but it's not like a hotel tax where the city actually it's really the cities and towns get the hotel motel tax. The state does not see any hotel motel taxes.
I know Quincy depends on that for a lot of things.
Yeah, that is not a tax the state receives. That is a municipal driven tax. And places like Boston, very much does that, plus the surcharges they put in rental cars is actually higher in Boston. That is a major money generator for the city of
Yeah.
Boston. And things like Uber and rideshare eats into car rentals every so often because people decide, I'm going to be here for like 2 days on a business trip. I don't see a reason I need to drive. I'll just take a Uber. Of course, that affects the taxi companies too. But I mean, that obviously can adversely affect a rental car company. People don't feel like I'm going to try to navigate the streets of Boston for like a 2 day conference.
It's interesting. Anytime you start to dabble with the capitalism, it's a whole cascading effect.
No, 100%. And there's a couple of just simple examples of unintended consequences of new technology and new business models that none of us could ever seen coming. None of us could ever see using technology in the way we are regarding, basic gig work, for lack of a term, running our own little business, generating a little side income, right? And some folks have converted that into a full-time business.
Oh yeah, the pandemic spawned many new pieces of businesses like that.
It's a one not the con sole contributor, but is a contributor, to the current housing crisis. I mean, I don't want to lay it on just one issue. I mean,
It's a multifaceted problem. That's probably what spurred this ballot petition.
that's correct. They're banking that people feel that the housing crisis can be resolved by lowering rents, but we're not, and then try to convince people that somehow this also helps increase supply.
Hi, probably why it was voted out the first time 30 years ago.
There's like, as you pointed out at the beginning, it's a degree of capitalism. People, it's also just two communities, Boston and Cambridge. The rest of the states, like, we don't do this. They had rent control or rent appeal boards in many communities under rent control provision, again, before my time. And do you trust any municipality to actually set rents? And the political consequences of which, because it becomes a populism issue regarding your local elected officials, and also becomes a very competitive issue regarding surrounding communities. We're in a very dense geographic zone. So whatever we do regarding rents will have a ripple effect to the next town around us regarding their rents. And which already does happen under a free market structure. And you toss in the political aspect of the fact that elected officials at the local level in particular, and smaller the district, the bigger it impacts, may be more heavily influenced maybe between developers and residents and activists.
Yes, I can see where that would be fraught with problems for sure.
Oh God, yeah. Imagine, you have the developers on you, and we know Quincy has a lot of developers. Let's not pretend they don't exist. And then you also got tenants out there who are trying to keep the rents low. And then you got advocates, and they got homeowners like, why are we doing this? Because it could result in a tax problem for perhaps, some landlords. What happens if you're in a town? Well, thankfully, this city's never done it, but Braintree had to do it. They had to do a Prop 2.5 override.
Yes, that's right. We're seeing more and more communities come up against that now, unfortunately.
Yeah, which increases property taxes, which then a rent control board would have to consider or not consider. And then if it's appointed by elected officials, which is most likely going to be appointed by elected officials, God forbid they're elected by the public, that creates all kinds of like new pressure in local politics.
Okay, stay tuned on that one.
We'll see what the voters do. I mean, I just really can't predict anymore where voters are going to go.
Yeah,
And
no, it still has to go through the certification process anyway.
exactly. But, honestly, I've not been good at predicting the outcomes of ballot questions.
No, I guess that's true. Because did you predict right to repair? I can't remember.
Yeah, I figured I was going to win. The marketing program was far too good against the details.
That's a good example right there of the devil's in the details.
Correct. The marketing didn't fully reflect the details of the bill, but that wasn't the point. They were looking to win a fight, and lots of money was put into it.
We probably won't be able to catch up next week, Tacky, because it's Thanksgiving. So what's in the Chan household plan?
Oh, I'm in charge of dinner again, so starting this Saturday afternoon, I'm going to be hard to find.
As I recall, last year you had roast lamb, didn't you?
We are doing it again because that
Oh.
is a family favorite demand now.
Oh,
So, they
okay.
want the cheesecake, they want the lamb, they want this roasted Chinese pork belly. I made you appreciate this perhaps. I made eggplant pecorino last time,
Yeah, that sounds good.
which is a lot of work actually.
It's a lot of work because you have to prep the eggplant before you even start cooking it.
Yeah, and you probably could prep it and put it in the fridge for a couple of days because
Definitely.
it ends up in the oven anyway. But last year I made it on the fly and I realized this is not one you can do in the fly.
No, that's not that's a that's a do ahead.
Yeah, unfortunately, it was very popular. So as a result, I got to do it again.
Start now.
It is, yeah, that's definitely like you start over the weekend kind of job. So yeah, I got to do a lot of prep. Starting shopping actually tomorrow's Friday. New coupons
There you go.
on the weekend, and try to beat the Thanksgiving rush on shopping. Just get.
Yeah.
Thankfully, we're not doing turkey or ham or something like that. So it's just getting all the stuff in the fridge and just doing all this prep work. So yeah, I'll be very busy next few weeks, and then of course this Saturday, actually the 22nd, Interior Social Service United Way is doing the turkey package, a giveaway to qualifying families. House Next having its holiday fair at St. Thomas Aquinas Hall, and then again, I'm sure. I mean, North Quincy, I believe, already had their holiday fair, which is
Yes,
cool.
they did. Yeah.
And I'm sure there'll be other local notice on small church fairs and various churches. Church fairs, obviously, churches running it. And of course, we've got the Christmas parade coming up on the Sunday after Thanksgiving, which is the last major event for the city. And it's the 4th anniversary. And if you missed out on seeing some of the floats and some of the displays they did during Flag Day, a Christmas parade is most likely going to see it a second time.
Yes, some of them will return. They've been purchased by the city. They're in storage in some secret location, and they will be brought out.
Exactly. So I will more likely than not, depending on how Thanksgiving Day goes for me, on exhaustion, we'll see. More likely than not, probably going to be the Christmas parade. And I'm not going to lie, guys, I'm probably going to jump out to the KFC and walk home. So
That's
if you
fair.
don't, you know exactly what I'm saying. So that's probably what's going to happen. I'll start the parade, but I'll get out when I'm close enough to walk home. And
Okay, well, you go by our camera location, so we'll catch you.
yeah, I'm not going to pretend, people, that I'm going to do the whole thing to North Quincy. So again, starts in the Firestone. Of course, plan your travel accordingly regarding the parade start time on Sunday.
Yes, there's tons of stuff before then too, of course. There's the lighting downtown on Friday night, the Santa at Pageant Field helicopter jump on Saturday, and then the parade.
Yeah, very much Quincy tradition of the Santa jump.
Yes.
So
Oh, don't forget the Thanksgiving Day football game.
exactly it. And again, this is Thanksgiving week. It's not this coming weekend. Yeah, there's still a lot of things to do, and I will give the city a lot of kudos. I mean, they do a great job on these holiday events, and you have the skating rink back up in Kilroy Square and Quincy Center. Yeah, plenty of family things to do as we go into holidays, and then the neighborhood tree lightings and local Christmas events start in December.
Yes. There's probably one near you.
I promise you, almost every neighborhood there's a tree lighting near you.
Alrighty. Well, how do we get a hold of you until we talk again, Jackie?
617-722-2370, 617-722-2370, room 42 of the State House. Tacky.chan at mahouse.gov is the email. State Representative Tacky Chan Facebook. We also have an Instagram. We've been using it more. We do have tackychan.org regarding local resources. Before you have to call my office, you can find some phone numbers that can help you there. We do have MA Legislature GOV. Very much encourage everyone to use MA Legislature GOV to track your bills, make your own account. I get the same information you get online because the information is almost simultaneously put up when the clerk puts up their system on reports and votes. They also come up basically almost simultaneously on the website. So calling me is not going to get you any special insight you can't get on yourself. And of course, Joe QATV. So email QATV@QATV.org if you have questions or want some comments about how this interview goes in this very free form, we don't know what's going to happen situation. And of course, since we're not going to be able to get together next week, I do wish you and yours a very happy Thanksgiving. And I wish everyone a very happy and safe Thanksgiving, as we're probably going to see each other in the first week of December.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. Same to you and your family. Happy and healthy for sure. Thanks, Jackie.